Hello, this is Atta Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 5th, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, Community Threads Bind Art and History. Quilters Guild exhibiting fabric crafts at Decatur Library, and this is part of the America 250 celebration. Donette Beckett Decatur has this article. Quilts are sewn into history. The Decatur Quilters Guild will exhibit a rotating collection of handmade quilts to showcase their history as well as the artistry. The rotating display will be at the Decatur Public Library's History Room until the end of July. A bed-turning event will be at 2 p.m. June 20th as part of the America's 250th anniversary celebrations. Multiple quilts will be stacked on top of each other. A flap of each one will be turned back while the moderator discusses the details. Some will be antiques and some will be ones that we've made, said Guild member Rita Hamm. One of the first quilts to be on display will be the Guild's raffle quilt, Delectable Mountain Star. Everybody had a hand in making that one, Hamm said about the quilt's production. We wanted people to see that one right away. The exhibit will be made up of various handcrafted quilts, some with historical patterns. Others may include the red, white, and blue material representing America's colors. We just wanted to highlight what a quilt is and how we design them, Hamm said. New quilts will be rotated into the display every 2 weeks. Guild members registered their quilts to be part of the exhibit. Brief information on each quilt is pinned to the display. The patterns and designs are often passed down through generations, Hamm said. Grandma's Garden is a pattern used in the 1700s, and it's still prevalent today, she said. There's the courthouse steps, the Lincoln's Log Cabin. There's names of quilts that have come down historically that are considered Americana quilt designs. The Quilters Guild is a nonprofit organization ready to help other agencies. We do a lot of charity work, Hamm said. Quilters meet from 10 a.m. to noon on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at Grace Baptist Church, 3770 North Water Street, Decatur. Sometimes we'll stay later and have an open sew, Hamm said. It just depends on what projects we're working on. Quilts have been donated to Project Linus, CASA, the Veterans Administration, and the Veterans Hospice Agencies. The members are also involved in other events that support the craft. There's something very Americana about the quilts in general, said librarian Alex Frazier. Quilting is a sense of nostalgia and history. Along with the history, the artistry, family connections, and camaraderie are also important to the quilter's preservations. So much is encompassed in what we think of when we think of quilts, Frazier said. Frazier brought her great-grandmother's quilt from the 1890s to be exhibited. Although it was originally used by the family, the past few years it has been a showpiece. It's safest here in the climate-controlled part of the building, Frazier said. The history room provides protection for historical items, including quilts. There's a bit more monitoring compared to out in the lobby, Frazier said. Oils from hands can cause damage, even to quilts. If they bring in anything older, we just don't want kids running through them, Frazier said. And there's a medium-sized, beautiful color photo here, an 1890s quilt. And the crazy quilt style is kept climate-controlled in the history room for the Decatur Quilters Guild exhibit in the Decatur Public Library on Friday, May 1st. And the square panels are divided into irregularly shaped triangles and other shapes, but not necessarily straight lines, some curved. Just a fascinating patchwork here. And photo credit goes to Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review. Two other medium to large size color photos. the Decatur Quilters Guild's 2026 raffle quilt titled Delectable Mountain Star is among the exhibit in the History Room of the Decatur Public Library on Friday, May 1st. And this is a beautiful quilt. I'm trying to describe it here. It looks like star patterns with squares in the middle and a white background and greenish-brown borders. Lots of texture, lots of stitching and interest. Joseph Ressler photos. And finally, through the end of July, the History Room in the Decatur Public Library is home to a rotating collection of quilts exhibited by the Decatur Quilters Guild. And there's several displayed here on standing racks. They are beautiful. There are three shown, one in the foreground and two in the background. Moving on to A2, the local page from the State House, state budget relies on tax hikes as growth lags. This article is by Rich Miller. More than a year ago, the Governor's Office of Management and Budget was projecting a $3.2 billion deficit for what is now the current fiscal year. Part of the problem was that existing revenues were flat, while spending was growing, according to the budget office. This is a recurring problem in Illinois. The previous fiscal year's projections were also astonishingly poor. The Chicago-based Civic Federation issued a report last week, which delves a bit deeper into why it is a recurring problem. Next fiscal year's spending plan achieves balance through a mixture of modest spending restraint, tweaking existing taxes, and levying new ones, the Civic Federation reported. New tax increases, not natural revenue growth, from taxation derived from economic expansion, have helped keep the state afloat. Since the income tax was raised in the summer of 2017, receipts from personal and corporate income taxes and sales taxes have grown 7.4% every year, the group found. That's above the annual non-Medicaid core expenditures. K-12 education, human services, transportation, and other services of 6.6% annual growth. Without the 2017 income tax hike, annual income and sales tax growth since then would have been just 5.2%, which is well below the 6.6% annual non-Medicaid core spending growth. The good news is that over the past decade, the state's growth in expenditures has essentially been met with commensurate revenue growth, the Civic Federation reported. The bad news is that this recent revenue growth is not sustainable. The state will eventually run out of options, the group predicted. And while cutting state spending is always mentioned as an option, it's important to remember some things. The state's K-12 education funding law mandates annual increases. Medicaid costs rise with medical inflation, which pretty much always outpaces the headline inflation number, and pension costs increase every year. Those three things represent most of the annual spending increases, meaning that other state programs would have to be slashed even further. Also, keep in mind that spending on core services this coming fiscal year is projected to be 13% lower than it was in fiscal year 2000 under Governor George Ryan, according to the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. This helps explain why progressive groups and legislators are demanding new taxes on the wealthy. With the added fiscal pressures imposed by the Trump administration on top of the inability of the state to fully fund pretty much any social services program it has, they're fed up and more people are recognizing the problem. The Senate Progressive Caucus, the Affordability and Tax Justice Coalition, and the Illinois Revenue Alliance all issued statements in the wake of the House's passage of the Bears Mega Projects demands in the same urgency and effort be focused on progressive revenue ideas. Senator Karina Villa, Democrat, West Chicago, for example, had this to say about the House action on Bears mega projects and its refusal to take up a millionaire's income tax surcharge. Illinois families were told there was not enough time to ask the wealthiest few to pay more. Yet there was time to move a Bears package that even the Bears management themselves say still needs changes. When Springfield decides something is urgent, it finds the time. Working families deserve to be treated as urgent too. The Affordability and Tax Justice Coalition has several progressive legislators on its executive committee and is pushing bills to create a digital advertising tax, close corporate loopholes, and further decouple from federal corporate tax cuts, enact worldwide combined reporting, and close luxury loopholes for millionaires. The group demanded that those bills must now become the central focus of our work for the next 4 weeks. The Illinois Revenue Alliance had this to say. On May 1st, thousands of Illinoisans will begin losing SNAP benefits while the ultra-rich and mega-developers continue to get tax breaks. The House's vote on the mega-project bill is proof that when there is political will, there is a way. I've seen these progressive revenue pushes come and go for decades. But the legislators and the groups behind them seem, to my eyes, much more organized, disciplined, and mindful of the requirements needed for passing major legislation than before. So this could very well be the biggest story to watch during the rest of the spring legislative session. It would definitely be quite something if a Bear Stadium deal helped achieve a decades-long progressive policy goal. But the Civic Federation warned about another Illinois problem, economic growth. The state is lagging badly in employment growth and the GDP growth. What we could end up with is continuing the trend of substantially more revenues from ever lower growth. Rich Miller publishes the Capital Facts, a daily political newsletter, in CapitalFacts.com. Local and nation here. Youths decide their favorite class snack. Second graders pick popcorn in lesson on election process. This article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. The excitement was building during a special election among the second graders at Decatur's Hope Academy. Popcorn or goldfish? What would be the favorite class snack? Jeremiah Miller and Eliah Wilson voted for popcorn. It's both snacks, and you can feel good about it, Eliah said. I would have felt happy for the goldfish, Jeremiah said, but I don't like goldfish. The final results were 24 votes for popcorn and 18 for goldfish. Although they still have another 10 years before their first election, the students were given an early lesson on the importance of voting. Decatur City Councilwoman Consuelo Cruz read a children's book she wrote titled Nova Runs for President. The mock election provided a hands-on example of voting as well as the snack afterwards. A Decatur native, Cruz explained why elections are important for her as a councilwoman. Go back to the community and help other people, she said. One way you can help other people is by voting. Casting your ballot is an opportunity to tell the government what your opinion is, Cruz told the students. When you graduate high school, you can vote, she added. You don't have to pay for it. You don't have to be rich or have a good job. Everybody gets to vote. But what happens when the vote ends in a tie, Jeremiah asked. We go through and count all of the ballots again to make sure that all the rules were followed, Cruz said. If it's still the same number, then there could be a re-election. The students have already experienced their first voting process at the beginning of the school year with a candy bar election. The traditional process was used, complete with a typical ballot and a barrier providing a private area. Cruz has worked with students in other Decatur schools, encouraging civic duties and responsibilities, especially voting. Her work with a civic group at Eisenhower High School motivated her to meet with younger students. I wanted to talk to them in a meaningful way, she said, so I thought I'd write a book. Parsons Elementary School second graders were one of the first groups to hear Cruz read her book. They were already studying governmental and civic leadership, she said. The kids were engaged and they asked great questions. Cruz wanted to bring the topic of the second grade level to the second grade level, creating that foundation, she said. Hopefully, That can be a core memory, she said. And hopefully teachers, the community, parents, church, and other civic leaders can continue to build on that. The councilwoman has heard the complaints about the challenges of making changes, even about the voting process. But this is your most effective way, regardless of your place in society, she said. You don't have to be a powerful person to affect change. You just have to go to a place and color in a circle. And some small color photos here. Alethea Black casts her ballot in the mock election, deciding which snack the second graders get at Hope Academy in Decatur on Friday, May 1st. And it's a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. It says election ballot for classroom snacks. And there are two choices and two rather large bubbles. And she's coloring in, looks like goldfish. And second graders Amari Cook and Deshaun Robinson make tally marks as City Councilwoman Consuelo Cruz counts the votes in the mock election at Hope Academy on Decatur, on Friday, May 1st in Decatur. And let's see here. And the large color photo that starts the article, Decatur Councilwoman Consuelo Cruz reads her book, Nova Runs for President, to second graders at Hope Academy in Decatur on Friday, May 1st. All photos by Joseph Ressler Photos, Herald and Review. More on the local page here. What's happening? High schoolers to showcase businesses. Decatur Central Illinois CEO Program will host a trade show for local high school juniors and seniors at Hickory Point Mall near the former Sears store from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 6th. The CEO Creating Entrepreneurial Opportunities Program teaches students about the world of business through hands-on experience, and the 15 unique brands on display at the trade show will highlight the students' creativity and entrepreneurial businesses. Students learn leadership, financial management, marketing, and customer service through their businesses, and those in attendance are encouraged to shop and support those businesses at the event. Also on the local and nation page, severe weather. Expert debunks tornado myths. This article is by Matt Camp, Jacksonville Journal-Courier. Already this year, Illinois has had more tornadoes than any other state. After storms on April 27th produced three tornadoes in the metro east, Illinois reached 111 tornadoes, according to AccuWeather. With activity on the rise, myths about tornadoes can lead to dangerous decisions. SIU Edwardsville weather expert Alan Black said several long-standing myths continue to be spread. Here are five common tornado myths and what Black said people should know. Myth: tornadoes can't travel up bluffs. There's a significant amount of research showing that when a tornado moves from lower terrain up over a bluff, it can change the storm's path slightly, Black said. Because of the tornado's rotation, ascending terrain can deflect it a bit, but we're talking about very small changes. Maybe 100 feet to the right or left of its original path, it does not protect us from tornadoes. Recent tornadoes in Edwardsville, including those in 2021 and 2025, show that higher terrain offers no meaningful protection. The 2025 tornado, which started in St. Louis, dissipated near the SIUE campus after a 23-mile path. Myth: tornadoes can't cross rivers and lakes. There's no protective effect from rivers or lakes, Black said. Tornadoes can and do cross them. There are many examples of tornadoes crossing the Mississippi River and other bodies of water. The river does not stop or weaken tornadoes in any meaningful way. The 2025 tornado in St. Louis tracked to near the SIUE campus, crossing the Mississippi River along the way. Myth: tornadoes can't touch down in cities and larger urban areas. There's no protective effect for urban areas, Black said. In fact, cities can be slightly warmer due to the urban heat island effect. Pavement and buildings absorb and re-radiate heat. There's some evidence that storms may strengthen over or just downwind of metro areas because of that added heat. The 2025 St. Louis tornado was rated EF3, with maximum wind speeds of 125 miles per hour. It was as wide as 1,750 yards. Myth: if driving during a tornado, taking shelter under an overpass is safe. Do not do that, Black said. Overpasses also act like wind tunnels, which can accelerate the wind further. On top of that, it's extremely dangerous from a traffic standpoint. Stopping under an overpass creates hazards for other drivers and can lead to serious accidents. If you're driving, get off the highway if possible and go into a substantial building. And finally, myth: the larger the tornado, the stronger it's going to be. Larger tornadoes can cause more damage simply because they cover more area, but size doesn't directly determine strength, Black said. You can have small tornadoes that produce very intense damage in a narrow path. Conversely, very large tornadoes aren't always the strongest. Tornado strength is determined by damage, not size. A wider tornado just has a higher chance of hitting something. As storm activity increases, Black said, some understanding what tornadoes can and cannot do may be as important as the forecast itself. On page A8, the money section, Disneyland scanning faces at gates. Privacy concerns raised as park looks to speed up entry process. This article is by Hannah Fry, Los Angeles Times, Los Angeles. There's nothing quite as identifiable as a face. Retailers use facial recognition technology to more easily nab shoplifters. Casinos have deployed it to keep card counters away. Even a popular New York City venue allegedly uses it to blackball people in its millionaire owner considers adversaries. So it comes as no surprise to many Disneyland guests that it's now being used at the entrance to the happiest place on Earth. Pretty much every other place is doing the same thing, said John Lashoffs, 73, who visits the park roughly every 6 weeks with his wife. The police, the government, they're all using facial recognition. I don't think it's going to stop. Photographs of a guest's face taken at the entrance to Disneyland and California Adventure are run through biometric technology to convert the images into unique numerical values. The images can then be compared with pictures taken when a customer first used the ticket or annual pass. Disney officials say the technology helps make entering and re-entering the park easier and prevents fraud, but the rapid growth of facial recognition over the past decade has raised concerns among privacy experts, who caution that such data can easily be turned over to law enforcement entities or make companies hacking targets. The normalization of facial surveillance is really problematic, said Ari Waldman, a professor of law at UC Irvine. We can't go around life hiding our faces, so this isn't just next step in surveillance. It's qualitatively different. In a world of facial recognition, when people leave their house, it automatically means they're identified. Venues over the past decade have increasingly begun to learn or lean on facial recognition to speed up entry and purchases for guests. At Intuit Dome, visitors can use Game Face ID to more quickly enter the stadium for Clippers games or other live entertainment. To use it, the guest just needs to upload a selfie, and the technology generates face recognition data to identify them at the arena. The venue's privacy policy states they may also infer whether you are over 21 from your selfie photo. Dodger Stadium also employs facial recognition technology for guests who want to use the go-ahead entry at certain gates into the ballpark. The technology allows park goers to enter without having to produce a physical or digital ticket. Some groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have raised concerns about the possibility of facial recognition and other biometric tracking technologies being used at the 2028 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. But at Disneyland on a recent Friday, vacationers in matching t-shirts, toddlers in princess dresses, and mouse-eared parents pushing strollers made their way through security checkpoints, giving a little attention to signs posted nearby, notifying guests of the theme park's new facial recognition policy. Use of this technology is optional. The signs adorned with red, green, yellow, and blue Mickey Mouse silhouettes reads, "The majority of the lines into the theme parks use facial recognition technology. Guests who don't want to run their face through the technology can use a separate entrance marked with a silhouette of a head and shoulders with a slash through it. Of the dozens of lines to enter Disneyland and California Adventure, there were only four on this day that didn't use facial recognition. Guests in those lines still had their photos taken, but the company said biometric technology wasn't used. Instead, an employee was seen manually validating tickets. Facial recognition technology has long been criticized for making mistakes when identifying people, particularly people of color. Research found that systems were less likely to accurately classify the faces of women with darker complexions, and that certain makeup patterns could render the technology null. There's also a risk of data breaches, experts say. If you collect this type of data, you have to put a target on your back for people to steal it," said Adam Schwartz, privacy litigation director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the nonprofit which opposes government use of facial recognition data, advocates for strengthening laws to protect consumers when the technology used by private businesses. Many at the park who spoke to the Times said deciding between the more than a dozen lines to enter the theme park came down to a simple calculation: which queue had the fewest people. Outside California Adventure, Robert Howell, 30, was sitting near the park entrance, waiting for the park to open for his first visit. Howell, who was visiting from Virginia, hadn't heard about Disney deploying the technology to check in parkgoers until he arrived at the park that day. "The idea of it made him a little uneasy," he said. "It's a little scary because it's not clear how it's going to be used," Howell said. "With TSA, I know that's an option that you can opt out. But I didn't realize you could do it here, so I just did it." Disney's data privacy policy notes that the numerical values created by the technology are deleted within 30 days unless they need to be kept for legal or fraud prevention purposes. And there is a small color photo here. Disneyland and California Adventure guests enter the park as the monorail passes by the entrance to Disneyland on March 11th, 2024 in Anaheim, California. And the monorail has various Disney characters on it painted bright yellow and red. And the photo credit is to Alan J. Shaben, Los Angeles Times. And with that, we have come to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 5th, 2026. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.